Welcome back to the New Books in Sports podcast. Our guest today is April Ace Smith, author of The Pitcher and the Dictator, Satchel Paige's Unlikely Season in the Dominican Republic. Thanks so much for being with us today, Ace.
Bob, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Ace is a political consultant and describes himself as a baseball fanatic, and he's been a political strategist and or campaign manager at just about every level of government, from the mayor's office to presidential campaigns. Would you talk a little bit about your background, you know, personally, academically, politically?
Sure. My background is very simple. I really grew up in politics. My father was the district attorney of San Francisco for 16 years, and my very first campaign was helping get him elected in 1979, and I fell in love with politics. And professionally, I've never done anything else since. I've loved baseball ever since I was a kid, and was a huge fanatic Giants fan my entire life. And the funny thing about this actual book was I never had an intention of writing a book in my life. It just happened one summer in 2005. I read two books. One was The Feast of the Goat by Mario Vargas Llosa, and the other was Satchel Paige is America by William Price Fox. And I discovered this amazing story. I went to check it out, and I found it was actually more amazing than it had ever been told.
Yeah, I love the story in your preface where you talked about buying a copy of the old official Encyclopedia of Baseball at a rummage sale for like a dime or something like that. It reminds me of back in around 1970, I got one of those big baseball encyclopedia. What fascinated you about that book?
I love the fact that it had the statistics for every person who had ever played baseball. And at that point, I thought I was going to go in the Hall of Fame myself. I believe I was in fifth grade. And so I would look over everyone's statistics and figure out the various pathways that I was going to make it into that book. But I also, the other thing I loved about that book was that they had these sketches or of all the major league stadiums. And, you know, there was the sketch of the polo fields with that huge tooth missing in the center field. I spent so many hours just thumbing through that book. I can't even tell you.
Other than the encyclopedia, what was the first baseball book that you read? Like for me, example, it was Pride of the Yankees.
The first baseball books I read were biographies, and I can't even think of who wrote them, that I picked up at dime stores on Hank Aaron. And it was about the time that I was really loving baseball was about the time that he was breaking the Babe Ruth's records. And I just picked up everything I could get my hands on about him.
And you played baseball as a youth also?
Very badly, yes.
Oh, we're kindred spirits then. Okay, good. You were a catcher, is that right?
I was a wannabe catcher.
was Aaron your favorite player?
My favorite players were really, at that time, the San Francisco Giants had one of the most amazing outfields. They had Gary Matthews, Gary Maddox in center, and Bobby Bonds in right. And it was this Matthew Maddox Bonds outfield that just really caught my imagination. There maybe never, you know, have been too many other outfields that could compete with that in terms of hitting and defense. And it was those early years with the Giants. And another little thing that made me fall in love with the game was for a year, maybe it was 2 years, believe it or not, Al Michaels was the broadcaster for the San Francisco Giants when I was in high school. And we just loved hearing him. It was just such a pleasure. And who knew that he was going to go on to become a national celebrity? But as a Giants broadcaster, he gave a life to the game that especially as a teenager, just caught my imagination.
And well, let's go to the book, The Pitcher and the Dictator. Long-term project. When did you start writing it?
I really started writing it probably in early 2006. The way it came about was I learned about the story and I was fascinated and wanted to find out where I could find out more about it. So I did a bunch of searching and realized that the University of Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara, had in their library the copies of the Dominican newspapers covering 1937. So I took a little road trip down there, and I spent a weekend reading through all the issues. As I went through it, I realized the story was way more fascinating than anyone had told it, and was actually in there in great detail. And I just became fascinated with the whole topic. And then I started writing the book. And one of the things that was very humbling, if you've never written a book — I've done a lot of writing in my life — you come to realize it's way harder than you ever imagined. And so I probably wrote and rewrote this book four times before I got to anywhere near what I wanted to accomplish. And it's still probably not perfect, but boy, just learning how to write a book is a thing of its own.
You're right. It's very humbling. I've written one also, and I remember looking at it and thinking, my gosh, I've got to cut X amount of words out of this thing. It is perfect, right? No, the editor said no. In the book, you focus on two distinct and flamboyant personalities, the first being Satchel Paige and the second being General Rafael Trujillo. I hope I pronounced that right. Trujillo, yes. What attracted you to Satchel Paige? What did you find fascinating about him?
I had known about Satchel Paige my whole life, and I loved his story. And more than anything, I'd remember reading his bio. I think I was in – or his autobio when I was in college, and just believing at that time that it was really not just a wonderful baseball book, but really a great piece of literature. And it will never get its due, unfortunately, because it was written by a sports figure. But it's this incredible American journey at a point in time when things are in tremendous flux in this country and are changing, and you have this incredibly flamboyant figure, probably the person in my lifetime who probably came closest to him was probably Muhammad Ali. But just the whole flavor of it just struck my fancy, and there's just no going back.
Yeah, Paige was a barnstorming and a marketing genius in his own right. And he certainly wasn't afraid to jump leagues if the price was right. I mean, he did it in North Dakota 2 years previous to the season you covered, went up to I think it was a semi-pro team and played up there. And then suddenly he's offered $30,000 to come and play for a team in the Dominican. And, you know, I did a rough calculation. I was just curious how much $30,000 would be in today's money. And it came out to be like $513,000. So that had to be an eye-popping amount for even Satchel Paige.
It was probably more than he had made in his entire career before that point. And he ran on, as you're well aware, he hit some rather rough times afterwards, and he needed every dime of it when he was done with the Mexican leagues.
Yeah. So what did you find fascinating about the Dominican in general and Trujillo in particular?
It's the Trujillo story is in some odd sense, it's a man who faced a lot of the same challenges in a different way, in a different country, in a different time than Satchel did. He was came from a poor family, from a relatively rural area, and he also had Haitian or black blood. And it was very hard to climb the ladder of opportunity in the Dominican Republic, even though they didn't have color bars like we had in this country in many parts. But it was hard to climb the social structure and the economic ladder if you had black blood. And his story is fascinating because he really is able to climb that ladder of opportunity because of the American occupation of the Dominican Republic from 1916 to 1924. And he became a protege of some of the Marine leaders who were down there, and they recruited him. And he realized that this was his great opportunity to advance in life. And so he learned everything he could from the Marines. When the Marines left, he became head of the Guardia Nacional, which was their essentially their state police, which he then converted into the Dominican Army, which he then converted into the presidency in a very underhanded way, but he was a person who had a lot of obstacles in his way, and I wouldn't say surmounted them. He maybe bulldozed through them in a way that you could only do in that country.
Yeah, I saw the one example that he used where he was he played sick and had the president come out to visit him and make sure he was okay. And, oh, yes, I'm okay. And he said something to the effect that there's some disturbances in the Capitol. So he sent some troops out and the president left. And then he sent some other troops out to countermand the orders of the first group that he sent out. He played his cards very well over there.
He did. And he had ingratiated himself enough into the Americans that when he seized power, they just looked the other way. As a matter of fact, they really gave him tacit support all the way until really the early 60s when the CIA smuggled in some guns to have some Dominicans assassinate him.
Yeah, and it's ironic that the Dominican Republic was like one of the more repressive regimes in the Western Hemisphere when Trujillo was the leader. And yet blacks like Satchel Paige enjoyed a status they could have never achieved in the parts of the United States, like the Deep South, for example. I mean, did that surprise you that it was so liberal in one way and so repressive in the other?
You're 100% right. And to this day, if you I spent a big chunk of time down there. And to this day, if you walk down any of the streets in, say, Santo Domingo in the evening, it has a very much a quality of Southern America that I was used to in the 1970s and 80s, where people are just sitting on their porches, on their stoops and talking, and people are just outdoors, they're listening to radio, they're sitting around playing cards, talking. And as you walk through, you realize that there's everyone of all different races all thrown together. And it really is one of those places that where everyone really mixes, never probably equally, but more or less much more so. And the great irony about what Satchel and his fellow players faced was here they were coming from the land of free, home of the brave, and going to one of the most repressive dictatorships in the world. At the end of the day, they probably had, in some senses, greater freedom there than they did in the United States because there was no color bar. And one of the great ironies of his journey down there and him and his fellow players was with this great freedom and pockets full of money, they could go to any bar they wanted to, they could go to any dance hall, any brothel for that matter. And they started having actually too good of a time. And as a result, Trujillo and his buddies put down the hammer because they started losing games. And he ended up, Trujillo and his buddies, installing essentially the head of his Gestapo as assistant manager of the team. And they put the word out to the players, you won't win. If you don't win, you will win or else, really. And they put the word out to all the bar owners and other such places that if you serve these players drinks, you're looking at a bullet through your head. So in some ironic way, they initially got the freedom, but then they got the dictatorship.
Yeah, that's some great incentive to play well. That's for darn sure. You know, and you touched on it a moment ago, there were other ways that racism was apparent on the island, weren't there? I think you said socioeconomic.
Yes, it really was. It really was. And Trujillo himself was so aware of this that as he grew older and became, he believed that whether it was true or not, that his skin pigmentation was getting darker. He would not even appear in public without caking his face in a white powdery substance to lighten his complexion. That's how aware he was of it.
Sort of an early day Sammy Sosa, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed, and actually some of that racism translated into the newspaper coverage. I noticed you had one instance where a sports writer referred to Paige and his two teammates as a very important trilogy of monkeys. and then suggested that they see, hear, and shut up. And I thought to myself when I read that, I'm like, whoa, that's really something to see in a newspaper.
And you'll also notice, and I've put up a website called thepitchingdictator.com, where I've posted a whole bunch of the images. Some of them are in the book, but the cartoons that were in the papers are pretty eye-popping as well. And it was pervasive.
That's true. You know, there's always been this myth about, you know, the infallibility of Satchel Paige, and some of it he probably, you know, brought on himself, you know, hyping himself. And yet in your book, we discover that he was, at times, he was rather pedestrian as a pitcher and even got roughed up a few times.
Well, that was most of his problems came when he really ran some bad arm trouble in Mexico. And it took him really between then and the return to the Monarchs to really get his arm right. But I found one of the most fascinating things in really learning about Satchel was understanding his very unconventional approach to pitching. And I found a really obscure book that I don't think too many people have read where he described his secret, very secrets to pitching and longevity. And one of the things I found just amazing about it was he talked about how he deliberately threw out of different arm slots during a game. He would go all the way from submarine to almost overhand on the theory that it distributed the stress to different muscle groups and different parts of his body. And he felt that that was one of the real keys to his longevity. And it's kind of interesting, as you know, today, all pitching coaches pretty much teach this theory that you have to get down this repetitive motion and repetitive arm slot, and you do it again and again and again. Satchel had a very different theory, which is certainly not conventional wisdom pitching. He also believed, and this is something that is not, you can see some of the pitchers coming from the Caribbean have mastered this, but not enough American pitchers, is he really understood that disrupting the timing of hitters was almost as important as throwing a deadly accurate fastball. And so he had just a multitude of windups, and he would also walk the rubber. So he would also try not to pitch from any particular part on the rubber. So imagine if you're facing him, he can literally pitch from anywhere on the rubber. He can come at you from a number of arm slots, and he's not going to give you the same motion. Plus, he has great speed and great accuracy in a number of pitches. So if you just do the odds on that of guessing what's coming at you, let's say the odds of facing a modern-day major league pitcher, it's maybe you're guessing somewhere all the different things, maybe 1 in 5 or something. With Satchel, if you do the math, you're probably guessing something like 1 in 300.
Right. Hitter never had a chance. In fact, in talking about this, you devoted a section in the book toward the back about his repertoire and his arm angles and all the different windups and names that he gave all of his pitches, which were, you know, they're fun and folksy, but, you know, a lot of them had a lot of truth to it. You know, the B ball, you know, it's where I want it to be, that sort of thing.
But probably the two greatest testimonies to his effectiveness were Ted Williams and Willie Mays. And the Ted Williams story is fascinating because Ted saved up his money as a kid just to go see Satchel and play in San Diego, and then played against him later. And when he wrote his book, The Art of Hitting or Science of Hitting, he argued very passionately that the reason why pitchers need to look at the Satchel Paige model is that he was constantly, as Williams describes it, changing the look from the mound. You know, you never knew where the ball was coming from. You were always surprised at the timing. And he recounted facing Satchel when Ted Williams was in his prime and when Satchel was an old man and never even hardly getting a bloop hit off him just because he was so confounding.
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, Williams probably didn't have a lot of respect for pitchers, but I'm sure in Page's case, he was very, very respectful. Do you? What about some of the other Negro League stars that played in the Dominican during that 1937 season? Can you talk about a few of those? And did they live up to their legends that we've read about all these years?
Well, probably the greatest but most unknown player is Martin de Higo, the great Cuban. If ever there was a player who was a two-way player, it was de Higo. And he really is someone who and I went out of my way in all these cases not to just believe the books that were written about them afterwards, but to dig into all the contemporary accounts of all the games. And as much as possible, I read not only the Dominican newspapers, I read a number of Cuban newspapers, I read a number of Mexican newspapers from the time of these games. And you quickly realize with de Higo that this man had a rifle arm, was a tremendous fielder, and he became later in life a dominant pitcher as well as a power hitter. There's probably never a greater player, all-around player who ever played the game. The man could play every position like an all-star aside from catcher. He's one worth highlighting. And the other one who I don't believe gets enough attention is probably Cool Papa Bell, who was, again, just a – not only was he one of the fastest players who ever played baseball, but again, if you dig into all the contemporary sources and you read the accounts, he was a man who could hit for power. And he was one of these players who, if he just hit almost a routine grounder, he had a good shot at beating it out. And he was a incredibly intelligent player, great center fielder, and again, probably deserves a lot more attention than he's gotten.
And then, of course, the big fish came down in the person of Josh Gibson, who has had books written about him, but he was larger than life, and he made a decent contribution to the team as well.
He probably was the force that really turned around the fortunes of the Ciudad Trujillo Dragones. It's kind of an interesting story. He was originally recruited and turned them down, and then he went to his owner, Composi, and in a very respectful way said, all these players are making huge amounts of money. They've offered me a huge amount of money. I'd like your permission. And Com looked at him and said, you know what? I can't pay you anywhere near that. This is more than you will make probably playing a few seasons. And I can't in my right good mind and conscience turn you down. And so he let Josh come down, and he led he hit for the cycle in a game. He led in every hitting category. The man was just a monster.
And Posey was a very enlightened owner for his time, because I can't imagine any owner right now saying, yep, go ahead, go to the other league. Godspeed.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
What was and you did a lot of research, obviously. What was the most challenging part about all this research?
Oh, I love research. There was nothing challenging. The thing that was most eye-opening was there's a real limitation to what you can there's some of the papers you can get in America. I traveled to the Library of Congress, a lot of different places, but what's at the Dominican National Archives is really breathtaking. And not only did they have all the the papers from the other cities, Santiago, which was the other major city, they had just a tremendous treasure trove of the local journals and other smaller publications that cover this, like La Tribuna, which is the publication which all those cartoons came from. And the funny thing is that I'm so used to American research institutions where you have to get lots of clearances, lots of permissions, and a very white glove. Down there, you ask for something and they send a couple people and they dig deep in. In some cases, they would bring me these volumes that were wrapped up in brown paper and tied with string, and they had been open for probably 50 years, and they'd open them up and we'd go through them and little flakes would be falling everywhere, but there they would be. And you really couldn't have done this without the help of the Dominican National Archives and the wonderful people there.
And I'm assuming that you can read and speak Spanish. Is that right?
My speaking, not so great. My reading is pretty perfect.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense when you're looking at newspapers. They weren't faded or anything like that other than what you saw? Sometimes you get in the National Archives and it's great stuff, but you can't read this stuff.
There were some close calls where there's chunks that are you're trying to figure out what they actually say. But I was able to find, in some cases where I was missing things, to find alternative copies of things in other libraries or other places.
What did you in doing this research? Did you learn anything that you didn't know before, or just gave you pause?
Probably the thing that was the most eye-opening to me was how inaccurate the story had ever been told, or inaccurately, and it's no one's fault. It was really Satchel's and the other players' tales that they told in the United States that just really didn't add up to what really happened. And what surprised me the most was that I didn't think some of the things I had maybe heard, speculated, I didn't think I'd ever be able to prove them. Like the kind of the wild partying that Satchel and his fellow players did down there. But ironically, and I don't think they were even aware of this, Trujillo ran the sort of regime where people were denounced in the press, and that's kind of the way he held his grip, very much like Stalin did with Pravda. And so what happened was they became very, very upset with the way Satchel and his teammates were partying, and so they denounced them full-throated and in great graphic detail in the newspapers down there. And what would have happened if Page and his teammates were Dominican, they would have been afraid of going to jail or getting shot. But I don't think, ironically, that they even knew it happened. I think the only thing they knew was that they saw they were being guarded by people with guns and things like that, and they got the message. But I was surprised at the amount of detail that was actually in the press at the time that allowed me to tell the story in great detail.
Yeah, there was one sports writer on the island who wrote very, very caustically saying, you know, the legendary Page proved to be a myth. It's unheard of. You know, we always heard.
Well, that was after his first outing. They all came around to Page's pitching after they saw him. He had a rough start, but then he won almost everything he touched after that.
Right, he won something like 6 or 7 games in a row, and then he had that one bad outing, and then he was in that last game which we really played it up dramatically. They were way ahead, and all of a sudden it just started, chipping away, and just very dramatic. And I could just see, you give the narrative with Satchel Paige, pawing the mound, thinking, oh my gosh, I got to get this guy out, or else, I'm not going to get back to the United States. There's a real fear there to throw a strike.
There was, and it was probably one of the coolest heads who ever played the game. Even got a little jittery.
Yeah. How did your background as a political researcher help you in this project, if at all? I mean, you've already said you love to research, but what techniques do you use that help, you know, that future researchers that are listening right now might be able to use?
I guess my outlook on everything is I always want to see what the primary sources say before I believe anything. I always want to see what's available at the time and dig as deep as I can in contemporary sources, again, without ever believing anything that's been written later until I know otherwise. And if you have that dogged determination that you can get your hands on original sources and piece them back together and tell a story without being influenced by later accounts, reminiscences, and all the rest, I think that's really the best lesson. And so really just taking the time to track down every contemporary source of every game, every box score, tracking down also everything that was going on at the times. And so I went out of the way to, for instance, when you'll see this when they're in New Orleans, to read through all the New Orleans newspapers and find out what was happening every day, and same within in the Dominican Republic, and to have a real, not just an eye on the baseball games were played, but what was the context, what was going on. And one of the things you find out in New Orleans is you find out that at the time that Ibar is there trying to recruit Page, there's this horrific lynching that happens in Mississippi, which is on the front page of the New Orleans newspapers for almost a week. And I'm sure that was a dominant, had to have been a topic of conversation, and also probably one of the reasons why Page and his fellow catcher didn't think twice about leaving.
Yeah. You know, I have this vision of you back in the stacks in a library, just sort of looking through a book or a document and suddenly just snapping your fingers and going, aha, you know, when you find something you can use that's very valuable. Am I close to the mark on that?
You're very close to the mark. And in this case, there were many, many ahas. And the biggest, there were little hints and pieces throughout it. But for instance, It's really hard to find since this doesn't exist anymore, pictures or recreations or maps or drawings of the stadium where they played in what is today Santo Domingo, at that time Ciudad Trujillo. And I had heard anecdotally, for instance, that there was this U.S. battleship which had been literally sitting on the rocks and rusting for decades. But I had no proof of that because there was nothing in the stories referencing it, because I guess people just, it was part of the scenery. They just took it for granted. And it wasn't until I actually found some cartoons from one of the newspapers showing the home runs being hit into the battleship that I was able to say, aha, that's where that battleship, it really was looming over the right field fence as you looked out. It was there. And so things like, there were a number of aha moments like that, of certain things which I had heard of, I suspected, but really didn't have the proof of it, because there's unlike the world we live in, where everything has been Instagrammed or Facebook 50 million times, and or you can look on Google Maps, that is not the world that existed.
I imagine that the world would be a lot different, would have been a lot different back then if they had social media.
Yeah, it would have. What's remarkable, though, is that the that world they lived in, because really the mode of communication is largely newspapers, there's probably, as much as we love recording everything on our video cameras and our iPhones, since they were depending upon the written word, there is so much that was written down that you really do have the ability to reconstruct this, maybe even in a better way than you could have just by with photographic evidence.
Yeah, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here. Every piece that I've read about you, and I've read a few of them in the last couple of days while I was preparing these questions, whether you were fairly portrayed or not, and you've had stuff on both ends of the spectrum, spoke to the idea that you came off looking like a rather quiet, sedate, offensive guy, and then all of a sudden you were feared because you were able to dig up the dirt. So I thought to myself, you know, knowledge really is power. Would you agree?
Oh, well, that's a funny topic. In politics, I've always run campaigns, and that's what I love doing. And there was a period in my life where I had done this in California, where I wanted to get outside of California and learn how politics was done in the rest of the country. And I came to the conclusion that I would have to do something besides just running campaigns to catch the attention of folks and to really kind of work in all these other states. And so I came up with the idea, and this was in the late 80s when it was really not even talked about, of this field called opposition research. And so I circulated all over the country, and it worked out very well for my life at that point because I had small children. And so I wasn't really able to live the life of running campaigns, which is really a 20-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week type endeavor. I came up with the idea of doing opposition research books and really kind of help in some small way create that entire field. And then when I was done doing that, it was something I never intended to do for that long. I went back to doing my passion, which was to run campaigns, and was able to come back and probably some of the ones you people would have heard of, was able to work on campaigns for people like Jerry Brown and Kamala Harris, and ran a few states for Hillary Clinton in 2008 campaign.
And I think you did Howard Dean as well. What year did you do him?
Yeah, we did some work for Howard. Yeah, that was back in his when he was running in 04.
Okay. That's before his yodeling that one. Yep.
That was
with that, did you?
No.
Even if you did, I don't think you'd take credit for it.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable campaign that you worked on?
Probably my father's campaign in 1979. It was a interesting time in San Francisco history. The mayor and the member of the Board of Supervisors, Harvey Milk, had been assassinated by a number of members of the Board of Supervisors. And the DA who had bungled that prosecution was running for reelection. And so it was like this incredibly politically charged moment in the city's history. And my father, who had worked in the Attorney General's office for a number of years but had never run for anything, decided to run for district attorney against the prosecutor who had bungled the Dan White case, which involved the murders of the mayor and Harvey Milk. And I took off a quarter from UC Berkeley to work on that campaign as a volunteer. And it's kind of hard to describe, but San Francisco politics at that point in time was probably as close as you get to, say, presidential politics shrunk down to a municipal level. It was something was talked about around every water cooler. Turnout was incredibly high, and there was a great passion, number of public forums, and really diving into that race. And my father ultimately beat the incumbent DA. Was just really, really one of the most wonderful eye-opening, but also just seeing my father win was just really one of the wonderful moments of my life.
And you were hooked at that point.
I sure was.
Who would you say, and you can include your dad if you want to, but who is the most interesting political figure you encountered, whether you know you worked for them or on the opposite side of the field?
Well, that's an easy one. I mean, the most interesting political figure, period, probably, far and wide is Jerry Brown. There is a talk about a brilliant man who's a complete iconoclast. But I had the great fortune of working with him when he was running for Attorney General and then later for governor. And he was wonderful to work with. He's still governor as we speak, but because he was a brilliant man who was towards the end of his career and had nothing to lose, and so was always able to say exactly what was on his mind and always do the right thing because he just didn't care about the political consequences. And so, aside from him just being a fascinating man with a brilliant mind, always has a point of view that you've probably never ever heard on any given topic. But also to be able to work with someone who was such a dedicated public servant, but who, because of when I work with him anyway, he wasn't looking around the corner at the next job, was able to actually act with great freedom.
And you've worked enough campaigns now to get a feel of the political landscape. How would you describe our political situation right now? I mean, is it more turbulent than when you started?
We are in one of the most polarized periods of American politics. I mean, you probably have to go back into the 1800s to find anything equivalent. And, for our contemporary view of things, we believe this is a radical departure. It's probably happened a number of times in American history, but it's a different world. And maybe the most different things are as follows. Number one, the news industry is completely turned upside down. News used to be driven by local and state matters from the daily newspapers. They are almost virtually defunct, and people get their news really from national and international outlets. And so what people know tends to be international and national news, which has flipped the entire paradigm of information. And so if you're working in state politics, people are actually relatively low information. If you're working in national politics, people know more than they've ever known. And so why did a man like Donald Trump succeed? He succeeded because, first of all, he understood how TV worked and how audience worked from having been incredibly successful. But he also realized that there was a certain pull he could exert on the media to drive it every single day. And he really has changed conventional wisdom on virtually everything about politics. And obviously people have very strong feelings about him, but when we look back on him, say 20, 50 years from now, we're not going to look back on him per se, but we're going to look back on a point when how we consumed information, how we reacted public figures, what are the rules of conduct public figures, were just all turned upside down and literally torn up and thrown out and rewritten.
And plus back, even 50 years ago, I mean, it was all newspapers and sometimes occasionally be national news, like ABC, CBS, and NBC. But now you have the internet, you have people going to their phones, people go on Twitter and break news that way, and people start, things snowball. So, I mean, it's just a totally different dynamic.
It certainly is. And there's a saying that when you're in the middle of a revolution, you don't really know what's happening, and we really are in the middle of a political revolution. I'm like to say I got all the answers. I don't think I have any more answers than the next person.
No, I will say that the president's probably, in a perverse sort of way, has probably rejuvenated the news industry because now they have all these topics to cover. It was pretty what do you call it, blah for a while. Now all of a sudden you've got CNN coming up with, no, we've got five breaking stories now, and they're dispatching people out there. So it's certainly different than it was maybe 5 years ago.
No question. And say what you want about him, he drives ratings.
He'll be the first to tell you, I'm sure.
True enough.
Here's the part of the interview where I ask you if I missed anything, is there anything you'd like to add about the book, you know, that I haven't mentioned or that you would like to mention? Mention your website again, too, though.
Oh, sure. The website is thepitcherandthedictator.com. And what you'll see is you'll see a whole number of pictures that I have in my own little archives that I didn't have room for in the book, all arranged in a way that you can look at them, and some pretty interesting material. The only thing I would maybe add is just one of the predominant themes of the book, and I think it's just a there's a moment in time we're at where we need to wake up to this is just the if you need to take note of this, not just as a baseball story, but as a story of really the heroic struggle of African Americans in America. And we're at quite a time in our own history, and if there was ever a good time to sit back and look at what previous generations went through and what African Americans went through just to get to where they are today. If there's a time to take stock of that and make change, now is the time.
Yeah, and also with General Trujillo, I mean, he was a savvy politician in his own right, because he took advantage of the good neighbor policy the United States was plugging very aggressively in the 1930s, because the Franklin Roosevelt, for example, was so afraid of German influence in the Western Hemisphere. So he was like, well, we'll look the other way. You do what you want, as long as you're with us. So I think he played that rather well. And even when they had that horrific massacre at the Haitian border, I think about a year or two later after your book here, I mean, the Western people tended to look away in general.
True. And one of the other ironies about the story was, and this is again why I actually put one of the advertisements for the series in the captions of the book and in the photos, was because people don't believe me when I say that there was a series that was played for the reelection of Rafael Trujillo. And there it is in bold print. And those advertisements that, the one I showed in the book, ran almost, every other day in the newspapers. It was very explicit. And the truth of the matter is that Trujillo was a wily, wily politician. As one of his henchpeople said later, yes, he was a dictator, but he worked very hard at it. And he would go to baptisms and baptize thousands of babies. He would travel the countryside. He was he not only controlled the press, there's probably some huge amount of it that he either dictated or wrote himself. He was not a dictator in maybe the sense of the word we think of someone who just was high and mighty and uttering some orders from afar. He was involved in every little detail of his government, down to literally like the number of uniforms ordered by his armies.
He was an OC dictator, in other words.
He knew what was going on. He really did.
Well, it's been a very interesting interview, and I can go on for a long time, but I know your time is valuable. Do you have another project involved as far as maybe putting out another book? And if so, what would the subject matter be?
That's a great question. I'm still recovering from writing this book. So I'll have to, having written a book yourself, you really do pour part of your life into these projects. And I'm still in recovery.
It's like the old Red Smith line about, you know, cutting open a vein and letting it bleed when you write. If you write well, you bled a lot.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Averill A. Smith, author of The Pitcher and the Dictator, Satchel Paige's Unlikely Season in the Dominican Republic. Ace, we really want to thank you for being on the show today. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. What a great pleasure. And I really appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to New Books in Sports, the channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bob D'Angelo, and thank you again for listening. Until next time, remember that the game is what matters.